Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thanks for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you from the wonderfully cozy studio in the back of Roberta's restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you are listening to Good Food, the show where we talk with people who are using food as a vehicle for social good. I'm your host, Daniel Meyer, and I'm very fortunate to be joined today by a woman who may very well be the perfect guest for this show. She is Judy Wicks, activist, entrepreneur, pioneer of the local living economy movement, which we'll hopefully get to in a bit, and founder of a Philadelphia institution, the White Dog Cafe. I say that Judy might be the perfect guest because she has literally just written a book called Good Morning, Beautiful Business, about turning a business, in her case, a restaurant, into, quote, a vehicle for social change. So this is pretty perfect. Judy, we're delighted to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So a few weeks ago, I start reading your book, and I sort of get sucked into it. You've had a pretty fascinating and fun-sounding life. The book is a pleasure to read, so the pages keep turning and turning and turning. And then all of a sudden, I sort of stop and look up for a second, and I realize, despite the fact that it should have been obvious from the title, Good Morning, Beautiful Business, that this is a business book. And not only that, it might be the very first book about business that I've actually ever read. And it really sneaks up on you, in large part, I think, because business, at least in the way that you conceive of and pursue it, is something that ought to be sort of completely intertwined with your personal life and values. So I'm wondering, when you set out to write this book, how did you envision it? Is it a memoir? Was it a business manual? Is it a manifesto or some combination of all three?
Well, when I started to write it, it was to be a business biography of the story of the White Dog Cafe, and that's what the publisher had approached me about writing. But as I got into it, I realized that it was really a memoir, that my business life and my personal life were so intertwined that they really couldn't be separated, and that the various influences on my business, you know, came from my personal experiences in life. So I'd say that it is a it is basically a memoir, but I think it is also a business book. And like you say, it doesn't seem like that at first, but then you realize that you're really learning a lot about business. And so I do encourage business people to read the book. It is a business book, but it's also a memoir.
And it seemed like, you know, just the way that you read the book and you sort of stumble on it being a business book, you sort of stumbled upon business just in the way that you were sort of living your life. How did you come into the restaurant business? How did you get there? Why did you stay there?
Well, that's kind of a serendipitous story in itself. My first business was actually a retail store called the Free People Store that I started with my first husband, who was my boyfriend from fifth grade. We grew up in a small town, and we wanted to start a business because we wanted to be independent, and we didn't want to be employees. We wanted to be able to express our own values and our own creativity and live by our own success and failures. So we were just too independent to work for someone else. So that's what really why we went into business. And I was in this retail store for about 2 years, and then I decided to leave the marriage and leave the business and sort of seek my own destiny, so to speak. And I got about a block away from the business that I was leaving and the marriage that I was leaving, and went through a red light and got into an accident. And luckily no one was hurt, but a passerby came along and said, you know, can I help you home? And I said, no, I can't go home. I've just left my husband and my bags are packed, and I've got to find a job right away because I've wrecked my car. And he said, well, he knew a restaurant where he worked that needed a waitress. And so I just said, well, I'll take it. And so when people say, how did you get into the restaurant business? I always say, by accident. So that's how it began. And kind of unlikely for me because I was a tomboy growing up and swore I would never cook and never have cooked because, you know, I always was able to go downstairs and eat at the restaurant. So it's worked out. And then I, you know, the restaurant, my career was really a 40-year career in the restaurant business. I just recently retired a few years ago and sold my company, the White Dog Cafe.
So you started as a waitress, and obviously you worked your way up, and you became higher and higher, and you became the manager. At what point, you know, at what point did you become comfortable enough working in the restaurant business that you decided that it was sort of a place not only to work, but use as a platform for your values, your social activism, you know, a place to do good in the world?
Well, I was there. I was in a management position for 10 years. Before I left and started my own business, and it hadn't been my intention to leave. I was thinking that I might stay in that restaurant indefinitely, but I had a falling out with my the person who became my partner there, the founder of the restaurant, and ended up leaving and starting a restaurant just down the street in the first floor of my house. And you know, and that turned out to be a blessing in disguise that it didn't work out to stay where I was, because by starting my very own restaurant, I was able to fully express, you know, my own personal ideas and values, so I was able to do a place that was very unique.
Was it sort of an easy decision to use the restaurant as a place to also sort of express your values and do good, because it's a fairly all-consuming business, and there was just no time to separate out your work life from your sort of personal values, that the only way to make it work was to commingle the two?
Yes, absolutely. And that happened back when I was at the restaurant where I was for 10 years. You know, I went into a business with a traditional perspective that, you know, you make your money through your work life, your 40-hour week or whatever, and that's how you make your money. And then on the weekends and on after work in the evenings, you might go to community meetings or volunteer, and that's where you address your social concerns. But in the restaurant business, because we're open at night and the weekends were the busiest times, there was no off times where I could do things outside of work. And really, work was where I realized I was focused. That's where I focused my time and my creativity and my money, and had the space and so on. So then I came up with the idea for time management reasons to explore all the concerns that I had in life through my business.
So could you just give us some examples or talk a little bit through how you started using the restaurant as a place to sort of explore your social concerns and your activism? What kind of programs did you start? How did you sort of bring people in from the community to get on board with what you were hoping to do?
Well, we did many, many things. For instance, we would have dinner talks where whatever the issue of the day was, whether it was you know, drug policy reform or foreign policy or concerns about public education, we would have speakers come, and some were internationally known speakers, like, you know, Helen Caldicott, the nuclear arms activist, or Lester Brown, the environmentalist, or Michael Pollan, the food, local food activist, mm-hmm. so on. People would have dinner and then talk about issues, or we'd have storytellings to give voice to underrepresented populations, such as recent immigrants or same-sex marriage couples. You know, so it was a way of building community across, you know, by developing more understanding. And then I guess we did community tours, affordable housing tours, community garden tours, community art tours, and so on. And then probably our most complicated project was our international sister restaurant project that I called Table for 6 Billion, Please, because I envisioned going to a restaurant instead of asking for a table for two or four. I asked for a table where everyone in the world could sit down, you know, sort of symbolizing the idea that everyone should have a place at the table politically and economically, and everyone should have enough to eat. And so we set out, I was trying to figure out how a restaurant could be involved with foreign policy. And I thought about, well, sister city, so why not sister restaurants? So we established sister relationships with restaurants in different countries where there was foreign policy issues going on. And the first was Nicaragua during the time that the Reagan administration was funding the Contras, mm-hmm. Contra revolutionaries, trying to overthrow the Sandinistas, who had overthrown the American-backed dictator, Somoza. a very cruel and relentless dictator. And anyway, so I wanted to find out what was going on down there, and came up with the idea of taking a group of our customers and staff to Nicaragua to visit our sister restaurant and ask them, what do you think of the Contras? What do you think of the Sandinistas? You're a business, and how are the Sandinista government handling business? Are they repressing business, or are they helping you, or what's the story? You know, so that's how it all began, and then we took groups to Vietnam to understand the impact of our economic embargo against the Vietnamese, and we took people to Cuba to understand the decades-long embargo against Cuba and how that affects the Cubans. And so on. So we can really be active citizens and knowledgeable citizens and understanding the impact of our foreign policy on others, and therefore inform our votes for candidates, and being informed about our issues and who would best address these various foreign policy challenges.
Were there any things that you learned from going to visit these sister restaurants in these countries that were often living under fairly repressive sort of governments that you were able to bring back to your own business in Philadelphia to inform the way that you did business, to inform the way that you sort of organized your community?
Well, in some ways, perhaps. I mean, one of the things that I found so impressive in countries like, for instance, Nicaragua, here was a country that was very poor and compared to our standards of living. And they were in a civil war that was really largely caused by U.S. supplying arms, to the counter-revolutionaries. And yet they had joy in their lives. They had, because they had a community, they had very strong sense of community and, of culture. I can remember being in El Salvador and trying to understand how our funding of the repressive government of El Salvador was affecting people, and would be at a dance in the jungle with the rebels, and you'd be dancing, and all of a sudden you'd realize like a machine gun was kind of poking you in the back on the dance floor.
Wow.
Someone was dancing with a machine gun on their back, and they used to talk about a tambourine in one hand and a rifle in the other, or whatever. When they're not that I'm a proponent of violence or guns in any way, especially right now and what's going on in our own country.
Right.
But just the idea that even when a country is at a war, these communities were so strong that they, they had a lot of joy and a lot of camaraderie, amongst each other, even if they were very poor. And that's something I also saw when I lived in an Eskimo village in Alaska, of how that happiness and security that did not come from money. It came from a sense of community, from security and the happiness that community brought to people.
So you obviously just touched on it, but I think one of the really heartening things about your book is sort of the way in which your restaurant grew into sort of a pillar of the community, something that relied on the community and something that the community relied on, and just sort of how you, both your business and you, grew up with that little block of Philadelphia that you lived on. Could you just talk a little bit what your restaurant's role was in the fabric of the community, why you took so much pleasure in not only saving your street from being razed, which you did, but then sort of helping it flourish all along?
Yeah, well, the White Dog was kind of a community gathering place, and people would come there to discuss the issues of the day. I think people were attracted to the White Dog not just for the good food that we serve, but also to be a part of a community of shared values. I feel like the White Dog created a community of shared values that really went beyond our local community into international relationships. We also were engaged with youth. We had a mentoring program to bring inner-city high school kids to the White Dog to learn about the hospitality business, and gave a scholarship to a graduating senior each year to go to restaurant management school. So we were, and we also did a lot of partnering with nonprofit organizations to make their work better known. For instance, we started having tours of the mural arts program which is a really beautiful local program of painting murals on the sides of buildings. And Philadelphia has become the mural capital of the world, I'm told. More
really?
Murals than any other city in the world.
Wow.
But we would take our customers around town to see the murals or see the community gardens. You know, when I'd hear about something or I'd see something, I'd always think, my customers have to hear about this. You know, my customers have to see this. And so then we'd design programs to take our customers to different parts of the city to see what was going on. It would have an eco, an Earth Day tour every year to visit solar homes or, you know, see different examples of for recycling or composting or whatever as models. So we were very embedded in the community. In fact, in the business world, we're always told, you know, grow or die, that you have to get bigger and start a chain of white dogs. But what I chose to do was to grow deeper in my own community rather than to grow the white dog as a chain into other people's communities. I saw that we could grow in other ways, that we didn't have to grow materially. We could grow by expanding consciousness or deepening our understanding or building community or, those other non-material ways of growing became a large focus of the white dog. And eventually, you know, education became a product along with food and service of the restaurant.
A full-service restaurant, as you called it in the book.
Right. Well, in fact, our mission, I believe that the purpose of business is to serve. And so our mission was to serve in four areas: serving our customers, serving our employees, serving our community, and serving nature. So when I made a business decision, I would think, okay, how's this decision going to affect these, you know, my customers, my employees, my community, and my natural world, as opposed to making decisions based solely on profit.
So we are talking with Judy Wicks. We need to take a very quick break, but when we get back, we will jump right back in, talk a little bit more about the White Dog Cafe, some other interesting things that Judy was into in her career. We'll be right back.
I just want to hold you, so nice and tight.
You're listening to Let It Go by the California Honey Drops on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Just let it go now, I ain't looking for no showdown. So won't you open up that door? Tell me once some more. Won't you stop all your keeping score now? Just let it go now. Let's talk it over. It was just this morning. We couldn't get along. You kept on saying all the things that were wrong. Yeah, you did. And now you've built up such a wall.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate: an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com. Did you know HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization? If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation.
We are back. You're listening to Good Food on the Heritage Radio Network, and we have been talking with Judy Wicks, entrepreneur, social activist, founder of the White Dog Cafe in Philadelphia. So I wanted to move away from the restaurant for just a second, Judy, and ask you about a pretty fascinating organization that you co-founded called BALI, which stands for the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. Could you parse for us a bit what is a local living economy and what is the kind of work that BALI does to promote and foster them?
Sure. Well, by living economy, we mean economies that support life, natural life, community life, and long-term economic life. And local, of course, means one's local economy, or, you know, regional economy. It would include, you know, the food shed and so on. And we started BALI, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economy, in 2001, and we're now a network of about over 30,000 locally owned independent businesses that are working in about 80 different communities in Canada and the United States. And BALI helps spread solutions, ideas, models of how to build local economies and the different types of businesses that we need to have in a local economy. We believe that local economies should be self-reliant in basic needs. In other words, we produce our own food, energy, and water, clothing as much as possible locally so that we're not reliant on long-distance shipping routes to bring us our basic needs, which is a precarious position to be in and which most communities are in these days, where we're relying on large corporations to ship food or energy, clothing, building materials, long distance. And these long distance routes can become prohibitively expensive, first of all, with the cost of oil going up, but also can be easily disrupted by weather and social upheaval. And we know that climate change is bringing both of more. So this is partly about survival, to make sure that local economies have what we need to live. And not be relying on outsiders to feed us.
So what's the practical way that BALI goes about equipping a community to be, you know, self-reliant in the way that you describe? Is it a matter of having sort of the right combination and number of stores that supply the community with all of the goods they need? How do you sort of create that infrastructure where it might not exist in the first place?
Well, BALI is a bottoms up organization, so we don't go into other people's communities and do things. We support those who are already working at the grassroots level by connecting them. So we connect leaders from various local communities that are doing this work. We connect them to each other so they can learn from each other, support each other, and we spread the models between the communities. And we also help to direct capital towards local economies. You know, by helping people to move their money from the stock market to local banks or public banks or local credit unions or whatever, that we show these models of how this is done, because we need money to build self-reliant local economies, and so we need to take our money out of the stock market and direct them towards creating a community-based economy that will help provide what we need to survive.
So obviously, much of the work that you're doing now and that you've done throughout your career focuses on you know, things at the very local level, building communities from the bottom up. But obviously, from, you know, all the work that you've done with the sister restaurants and in Nicaragua and Vietnam and the Soviet Union, you don't think provincially. You have a very global perspective. So I'm wondering how you know, how that sort of that BALI mentality of building self-reliant communities extends beyond individual communities and sort of forms the fabric of entire countries and even functions on a global scale. Like, how you know, how do we have a world of sustainable communities and economies and not just sort of individual ones?
Well, you know, we're always going to have a global economy, and by having our focus be on local economies, we're not excluding that. We feel that local economies should produce their basic needs, but that we then trade nationally and globally and things that we have excess of or things that we've created in our community that are unique, you know, a unique fashion, a unique wine or cheese or invention or whatever that we trade, or art and culture that are traded around the world. So we envision a global economy that rather than being dominated by these large corporations that concentrate, you know, wealth and power. We envision a global economy that's this intricate network of small to small around the world that connect these self-reliant local economies through fair trade relationships amongst each other. So it's a vision that sees our economic transactions decentralized and ownership decentralized, so that businesses are, for the most part, locally owned and connected through fair trade relationships. So it's not anti-global. It's more, you know, about local self-reliance and then trading globally in what we want to trade in, rather than what we absolutely have to in order to survive.
Right. You said you had some interesting sections in the book about sort of the appropriate scale for a business, or at least for your business, and about the idea of sort of continual growth. You know, how do you obviously got to a point where you decided that you know, you could have had a whole chain of White Dog cafes and that would have made you a lot of money, but that kind of profit wasn't sort of the capital you were most interested in. Trading it had a greater social and community value for you to keep, you know, keep your one restaurant and then share what you had learned with other businesses. I'm wondering, how do you go about sort of instilling those values in other people who are business owners who may have a profit, you know, a monetary profit first mentality? How do you sort of proliferate the kinds of businesses that you owned and that you think are most beneficial?
Well, I think it really comes down to changing our measurement of success. That in our culture, unlike indigenous cultures that I've experienced in my life, in Alaska and other places, you know, we value, you know, our success. We base our success on how much we have, how much material goods we have, and certainly in the business world, we certainly do that. And in business schools, you know, Warren, you grow or die, and they mean grow materially, you know, having more and more units, growing larger and larger. But, you know, that has disastrous consequences when we're living on a planet with finite resources. We're using up more natural resources than the Earth can replenish, and we're causing more pollution than the Earth can absorb. And we've gone past the point of sustainability a long time ago, and yet we continue to grow and use up more and more resources and waste more and more and so on. So we need to change our measurement of success away from material wealth and base our measurement of success on the health and well-being of our communities and of our natural world. And that means really changing how we value success in our businesses. That's not about making more and more money. It's not about maximizing profits. It's about maximizing relationships. You know, the relationships we have with our employees and our community and our natural world, because that's what will lead to long-term financial sustainability. If we keep doing business the way we are, we're going to destroy our home on planet Earth, and we won't have any businesses. And we're also just increasing the inequality among people to base our success on our individual wealth. We need to start thinking about the wealth of our communities. And when we bring ownership back to our local communities, when we're bringing economic power, we're decentralizing ownership and thereby decentralizing economic power and political power. That we all know that we're in a crisis right now in this country because the corporations have undue influence on our government, and it's not a partisan thing. It's both parties are largely controlled. They owe their jobs to large corporate donations, and that the federal, you know, the federal Supreme Court decision and the Citizens United, you know, opens the doors to unlimited campaign finance by corporations. And so we're in a real bind here. Our democracy is being threatened, and we need to address that politically, but we can also address that by what kind of economy we have. We can take power away from large corporations simply by buying local and by starting businesses locally to provide our needs. So, you know, it's a really important time, I think, in history now, and business has an important role to play. That, you know, entrepreneurs can really help save the day here by starting local businesses that provide more self-reliance for our communities, by starting the businesses we need to process local foods, to manufacture locally our clothing and building materials, and to also develop sources for renewable energy so that we're all have renewable energy that's locally available to us. And I feel, and our movement feels, that when every community has food, water, and energy security, that that creates the foundation for world peace.
So we need more local businesses. That's clearly a priority. And one thing that, that sort of becomes pretty clear pretty quickly from reading your book is that you took great pleasure in and had great success sort of diving into your businesses head first without necessarily seeing where they were leading and where the bottom might be. I'm wondering if you have, I don't know, any advice or words of wisdom for people who might share that impulse to start a project or start a business, especially those pursuing projects in sort of the wider food world where there's not always a clear path and, you know, sometimes a leap of faith is really the only discernible way. What things sort of helped you be successful in this world and what might you have to share with others who want to do the same?
Well, I think a very important part of starting a new business is to really think about what your community needs. You know, obviously a large part of it is what your own passion is. You know, what are you interested in? You know, whether it's, you know, food or furniture or energy or whatever, but also to look what your community needs. I know for me, when I felt the desire to do something more with my business rather than starting a White Dog Cafe in someone else's community, I looked to see what does my community need.
Right.
And we didn't have a retail outlet for locally made goods, you know, local pottery and jewelry and glassware and so on. So I started, instead of another White Dog, I started the Black Cat, which is our retail store next door, because that's what my community needed. So I think that's really an important thing to, first of all, to choose a community, to be rooted in community, to be dedicated to a community, to be knowledgeable of that community,
yeah,
and to understand what the community wants and needs.
Okay, I think we only have a minute or two left, so I wanted to ask you one last thing. A lot of things that you did at the White Dog Cafe seem to be truly on the cusp or ahead of their time. You know, you were a pioneer of local sustainable food, craft beer, fair trade sourcing, renewable energy, paying a living wage, and probably a lot more that I can't remember off the top of my head just now. So, you know, just so we all get to see, you know, 20 years into the future to see what things are going to be like, tell us what you're up to now. You no longer have the restaurant, but you're obviously keeping quite busy. So what are you up to that we might have to look forward to down the road?
Well, I'd say that one of the most important things is to work with the next generation that really, you know, I'm in my mid-60s now, and you know, I'm not going to start another business, but I would like to help and I'm helping young people with their businesses to have more beautiful businesses, you know, in our economy. So that's where I think we should, those of us who are in the baby boom era and have some business experience, I think it's a good idea to look at what the 20-somethings and 30-somethings are doing in the business world and to lend a hand.
All right, so you heard it. If you are a young person and you are out there looking to start a beautiful business, we have people like Judy and others like people at Bali to rely on for advice. Judy Wicks, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening. I'm trying so hard not to.